Accession number 28410, Reel 3.
Which took 10 303 bullets in two clips of five, which you pressed with your thumb into the magazine to load the magazine. Rifle drill, sloping arms, presenting arms, and doing all the other things you did were part of the training. This was done while marching and in squads. And then we had time on the rifle range, not far from the camp, where we did practical training in firing the rifle. Naturally, there were many of our people in those days, particularly the country people, who had quite considerable experience in the handling of firearms, and in many cases were quite good shots. And I remember distinctly one of the trainees who was asked to identify the shots on his target because someone else had also fired on the same target. And he was quite adamant that his targets were all in the vicinity of what you might call the centre of the target or the bullseye, as compared with the assorted splatter of shots on the outer sides of the target. This man, army nickname, was Trader Horn. He had been an active miner and hunter in parts of Africa pre-war.
What degree do you think men joined up for adventure?
Well, I personally think that in those days one could only say that most, I think, joined up for adventure. Something new, something different. It was rather important to realise that the entire constitution of the second AIF force was of men who volunteered. There was no conscription whatever for service in the second AIF, as distinct from perhaps the call-up in subsequent Vietnam War for service in Vietnam. Although I do believe, and I can't be sure of this, that there was a call-up for the CMF section of the force in the Second World War, but these people in the CMF were limited to service only in Australian territory, which was extended to include Papua and New Guinea. My brother served in the CMF and served in what was called ANGOW, the Australian New Guinea Administrative Unit, and was lent to the American forces for what would appear to have been rather special duties.
Let's talk then about the thought of going away overseas to fight for king and country. What did that mean for you?
One didn't think of going away to fight for king and country so much as being an embarkation for an unknown destination on an unknown form of transport as an exciting overseas trip, which in the main none of us could have in those days afforded. So it was with a great deal of excitement and anticipation and expectation that we were given pre-embarkation leave and moved by rail from Brisbane to Sydney, a trip of probably 24 hours travelling time on the railway, and we were taken straight to a wharf in Sydney to discover that we were embarking on the enormous Queen Mary ship in Sydney Harbour.
Had you heard anything about the way that the war was going up until this time?
Yes.
What had you heard?
Our newspapers, of course, reported quite extensively on the Dunkirk evacuation and the overall movement of the Nazi forces through the Ardennes Forest to outflank the Maginot Line of the French and to occupy the Low Countries of Denmark, Belgium and Holland and France.
At that time, what had the feeling been?
Well, probably at that time we realised that we were going to become involved in this somewhere.
Well, they're a pretty impressive force, the Germans. I mean, did that ever deter you?
I don't think there was any question of the Australian Imperial Force being deterred by the thought of what was ahead of them. Because by that time, of course, we probably had in our minds the model of the first AIF and their achievements in the Middle East, that's in the vicinity of Palestine and Egypt in the First World War as the Australian Light Horse, and by the other units from 1916 onwards in France and Belgium, where most of us had either a father or uncles or relatives who had served in some aspect of the First World War.
How strong was the spirit of the Anzac?
I would say the spirit was as strong with the second AIF as it was with the first AIF. You realise that when we left Australia, we didn't know where we were going to disembark or finish up. We had in mind that it could be in the Middle East, or we could have gone directly to the United Kingdom. As it happened in the case of the voyage we made on the Queen Mary, we were surprised to find that we were landed in what was then called Bombay on the west coast of India and moved by train up to the Sepoy barracks in the famous Indian Army town of Pune, where we spent probably a week doing very little except go on leave into the town and back to the barracks. We did a little bit of drill and showmanship on parade grounds and discovered the sort of life that the regular British soldiers enjoyed or put up with in places like Pune over the years. I recall that we had no Australian military police with us in Pune at that time, and on one occasion, as a sergeant, I was given the job of taking a patrol of, I think, about 20 members of the unit into Pune to be off-siders to military police in Pune. We were all issued with an armband which I think had GMP on it, and in theory we were to act as military police. The thing that happened while I was there was that in a cafe, we were all riding, by the way, bicycles, which were issued to us by the British Army, and they were typical English bicycles, which were rather different in appearance to those that Australians wore, particularly the handlebars. You were sitting on what was probably a rally-type bicycle with straight handlebars, whereas the Australians were used to riding bicycles with racing handles. Well, anyway, a rather extensive brawl developed between Australians and British troops in this restaurant, and there were quite substantial damage being done. The British sergeant said to me, "Let's go in and stop the brawl." I said, "Let's go down to the railway station and see what's happening there." He felt rather surprised. So we took our patrol down to the railway station, and after about perhaps three quarters of an hour, went back to find that the brawl was finished and the proprietress of the restaurant was screaming for the arrest of the people who had caused all this damage. I asked her if she had a private office, and she said yes. So I said, well, let's go and have a talk. So we went round to the office, and I said, look, if we start in there trying to arrest those people, as Australians, we'll become involved in a brawl similar to the one that you've just seen. And secondly, when we get back to our unit and report all this, they'll simply put your restaurant out of bounds for the rest of time. And at that point she said, oh, I wouldn't want that. The reason being, of course, that we were getting, on the average, about 6 shillings a day compared to 1 shilling a day or whatever that the British troops were getting. So no arrests were made, and my army squad of supposedly acting military police were invited round at the close of the evening, about midnight, for a free meal by the proprietress, who was very keen that we didn't report the brawl and have her place put out of bounds.
Where did this trouble come from, do you think, between the Tommy and the Australian?
I can't really tell you what caused the trouble because I wasn't in the cafe when it started.
Was there a sort of animosity between the two, anyway?
There was quite often animosity between United Kingdom troops and Australian troops on leave, much the same as, for example, when there was animosity between Australian troops and American troops on leave in Australia later in the war. But in that case, probably for different reasons. I'm not absolutely sure what caused minor dust-ups between Australians and other troops.
My impression is that the pay had, you know, the fact that the Aussies got more money was a bit of a problem.
Well, the problem was probably due to the fact that Australians got preferential treatment because they were getting more money. By the same token, the American troops in Australia during the Second World got substantially more pay than Australians, and this, of course, caused similar trouble. In point of fact, the so-called Battle of Brisbane, at one stage in the war between Australian troops and American troops on leave, was possibly caused by the fact that the Americans' canteen, or whatever they call it, was able to supply their troops with silk stockings and other things which they could give as gifts to Australian girls, whereas the Australian troops didn't have access to that sort of thing. And secondly, the Americans had almost unlimited supplies of cigarettes.
Let's talk about the Queen Mary. What was it like to be on board the Queen Mary? First time on board a ship like that.
One, of course, had read about the Queen Mary, and to find oneself on board was quite thrilling. There were rather different aspects on that trip to subsequent trips by that ship. For example, when we boarded it in October 1940, it was, I think, what they would call a charter party, in that the ship was chartered and still operated as more or less a civilian-type ship. Mind you, there were an enormous number of troops on board, and there was an officers' mess, which had an incredibly good menu. There was another mess for warrant officers and sergeants, which, as far as I was concerned, was also an incredibly good menu. And the troops were catered for in the main big dining room of the ship, and the meals were divided up to sessions, so that I don't know how many there were, but there could have been, for example, three servings of breakfast and the same for lunch and the same for dinner. But generally speaking, the catering was of very high standard, and quite a number of Australian troops who had the requisite skills were employed and paid by the ship. For example, I know that at least one or two men from our regiment who were bakers by profession worked in the ship's bakery. And sundry others were employed in some sort of duties such as that. The early stages of occupying our quarters on the ship were rather unusual. For example, the sergeants of the 2nd Anti-Tank Regiment, in which I served, were given accommodation in the cabaret on the sun deck on the aft end of the ship. In other words, we were on almost the rear of the ship and very high up on the ship. There were no mattresses or hammocks at that time. We seemed to be required to do the best we could with what was there. This, as far as some troops were concerned, you had groups of three or four men in what were quite elaborate cabins on the ship. And these cabins were equipped with all the facilities, in particular with built-in baths, which were supplied with hot or cold salt water and special salt water soap was issued so that you could get a lather up with the salt water. One of the spectacular things about running a bath in a cabin at night when the ship was blacked out was the fluorescent stream of water that came out of the tap. There was very little one could do on the ship. It was possible to buy beer, and there was the need always to have your life jacket with you and a bottle of water, army water bottle, in case you had to evacuate the ship, in which case there were obviously not enough lifeboats to cope for the thousands of men on board, but there were huge sort of rafts that could have been brought into use. The ship, of course, had a very large artillery gun on the rear and assorted guns in sandbag emplacements on either side of the ship. As a matter of interest, another member of the unit and myself, who had previously in civilian life been active members of what was called a fencing or sword club in Brisbane, discovered that the ship's stores still contained all sorts of sporting gear for the use by pre-war passengers, and this included fencing epees, swords and foils, and we were able to borrow some of these together with the face mask and jackets and amused ourselves on one of the very, very upper sections of the ship in what was called the dog enclosure. This was a small area screened off with a sort of wire-type fence in which dogs were paraded when carried as for passengers. So we enjoyed ourselves fencing up there as an exercise and as a sport.
What of other activities on board ship? People talk of boxing and two-up and, you know, generally keeping the troops amused.
Boxing in particular was a very popular entertainment. This took place on the deck at outside where we sergeants were quartered in the cabaret. And a number of our regiment were quite proficient boxers. And in point of fact, Bombardier Duckring was one of our members who won the championship in his class on the ship. He was unfortunately one of the members of our regiment whose gun crew was overrun by the French in Syria, and he and a number of others were killed. I recall that in post-war, his widow, who had remarried, gave our regimental association the certificate he got from the ship's captain about his boxing victory, and I made this available to the Kedron Returned Servicemen's League to place in their museum as an exhibit. It was still there when I last visited Brisbane in July 2005.
let's talk then about your trip. What was it like? Presumably you came around to Western Australia and then head off to Bombay.
We got on the ship in Sydney, and there was at that time another ship in the convoy with us. It was either the Aquitania or the Mauritania. We left Sydney, sailed south, and obviously went well down towards Antarctica in a large circular sweep. And ultimately discovered that we were standing off Fremantle in West Australia. The Queen Mary was too large at that stage to enter Fremantle, or maybe it was too dangerous to take that ship in there. But we were then joined by a third ship, which had obviously been loading troops in Fremantle. So the three vessels, the Queen Mary, the Aquitania and the Mauritania, moved off in convoy for then a place unknown. We sailed through the Indian Ocean, and at one stage encountered a very heavy storm, which was rather interesting because the Queen Mary rolled quite severely.
I understand that people have said that the Queen Mary couldn't roll.
The Queen Mary took half an hour to roll to port and half an hour to recover to starboard. It was a long, slow roll. In post-war times, this was rectified somehow or other. I was rather fortunate on the voyage in discovering that one of the ship's engineers had been a sugar mill engineer in Maryborough in Queensland, and I had worked for a sugar industry organisation and was taken by him on a tour through the ship's engine rooms, etc., and was taken to see where the four propeller shafts went through the rear of the ship, through the stuffing boxes that were the bearings to hold the weight of them. These shafts were about 3 feet in diameter.